Breaking It Down with Frank McKay. This is 103.9 LI News Radio.
I'd like to welcome everyone to Breaking It Down. Frank McKay here. So much more importantly, one of the finest stand-ups you'll ever see. He also does some acting and writing. Thrilled to have Michael Somerville with us. And Michael, how are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on.
Listen, thrilled to have you. And I was just telling you off mic, you know, I don't know if I went all into this, but I mean, you've had me in tears sometimes listening to the Sirius and just listening to your stand-up. And it's dangerous, you know, because I only have it in my car. You're just laughing and you got to watch people next to you are looking at you like, is he laughing at me? What's he laughing at? It's a weird dynamic.
Well, My parents were in tears when I said I was going to become a comedian. So so there we go. No, I appreciate it. I'm really flattered, man. Thank you so much for saying that. It's good to hear, too, because, you know, you do these jokes and you make these albums and you don't know. They go out into the world. You don't know. You don't hear anything. So I really do appreciate the feedback. I'm glad someone's laughing.
Yeah, well, listen, a lot of people are. And, you know, you can tell by how much you're getting played. I mean, you get played all the time. And you know, on these things, and you're someone who was on Letterman, I think it was The Late Show, right? Four times, something like that. I mean, that's it.
Yep. Letterman four, eight if you count reruns.
Yeah. Oh, no kidding. Well, that's a big deal. Listen, The Late Show with Letterman, this is before, like right before it exploded into 500 stations or whatever. And, you know, and the audience that he had on that show was just, it was unbelievable. I mean, it wasn't like what Carson had or what he had on Late Night, you know, because there were more, or less, I should say, outlets. But really, I mean, you could build a career just off of a couple of appearances on Letterman.
Well, yeah, that was back in the day, you know, obviously you got on, you killed, and Carson brought you to the couch, and you lived happily ever after. I have a specialty, I get on things once they're no longer relevant, and so... I got on Letterman once he stopped giving out sitcoms, once he was near retirement. You know, that's when I made my run. So,
Well, hey, listen, he's, you know, Letterman's always relevant. The resume piece of being on Letterman is a huge thing.
I agree. No, and I certainly didn't mean that to be a slight at him.
No.
So I was thrilled to be on the show. I was lucky that they saw me. They haven't seen me in a club and liked me. And, it was the best, you know, I was on four times in just a little over 2 years. And, It was the most fun I've had in my career. I grew up seeing Letterman on TV. I had older brothers who were always watching him. So to be standing on that stage and hearing Dave's laugh, you know, behind me as I told jokes, it was really pretty special.
Yeah, and I think they're very particular about who they put on, especially more than once. They might give you a shot, you know, like if you're on the bubble, but they don't put you on four times unless he likes it.
Well, that's what everyone keeps telling me. Yet he never spoke to me, that's for sure. I mean, everyone keeps going, Dave must really like you. He must love you. Do you go to his house for Thanksgiving? I said, no, the guy never says that. Our entire relationship was televised. Anything that you saw every minute that he spoke to me was on TV, and that was not much.
Yeah, well, listen, it doesn't matter. It's huge, and it's a huge audience to have. And you mentioned, you know, in jest, your parents were crying when you told them. I'm telling you, I don't know if you're kidding, but I imagine that a lot of parents of comedians say, oh, my God, no, please, God, don't do this. You know, what were your parents like?
That, you know, that's exactly, and I think, you know, most parents, it's not so much about don't be a comedian, but obviously they all want us to be stable, have, you know, health insurance, have a good life. I mean, you know, parents just worry about that stuff, so. I think the perception, especially my parents who just grew up, you know, in the Bronx and worked hard to get out of the Bronx. And, you know, it was all about just, you know, get a little something for yourself in life. And all of a sudden, you know, diving into the abyss that's entertainment, I think terrified them. But I will say once they saw me on TV, that went a long, long way to say, like, oh, you know, maybe this is not so crazy. But then after about 6 months, it wore off and they needed to see some new evidence that I was doing the right thing.
Then they wanted to start looking at your bank book. I don't even know if they have bank books anymore, but they wanted to start looking at things like that. But what about the kids growing up and your high school friends? And actually, before you answer that, let me remind everyone of who they're listening to. Frank McKay here, much more importantly, wonderful stand-up and an actor and writer. He does a little bit of everything, but what he's great at, and I mean absolutely great at, is stand-up comedy. Michael Somerville is our very special guest. But the kids in high school and you know, junior high, whatever, the hometown kids that you grew up with, you know, again, there's always this this dynamic that there's this drunken frat boy mentality among them where they tease you because they kind of saw you in diapers, you know, so whoever you are, they saw
exactly.
You, you know, whatever. But what was it like when you first started running into kids like that after, well, the people like that, I should say, that you knew as kids, but after you appeared on Letterman, after they started seeing you on TV?
Yeah, that was pretty exciting, actually, because I grew up in a nice suburban town in New Jersey, and yeah, maybe about 10,000, so not a small town, but, you know, everyone sort of knew each other, and, you know, a lot of the guys kind of hung out or still lived nearby, and, yeah, it was kind of wild for them to all of a sudden, it kind of legitimized, like I said, even about my parents, same thing with them, it kind of legitimized it, you know, Somerville's doing what, he's telling jokes, come on, and all of a sudden you hear Somerville's on Letterman tonight. And it kind of like, you know, you legitimized everything. All of a sudden they were all supportive and tweeting and Facebooking and everything. And that was really kind of fun. But the people who weren't impressed were my older brothers. That was the best part. I mean, hey, these two older brothers who grew up watching Letterman, and I'm on Letterman, and you're still just a younger brother to them. I mean, they just, you know, they were like, I mean, they were excited for me, but they didn't, you know, it wasn't like I suddenly was the head brother in the household. I was still number three.
What do your other brothers do? What do they do for a living?
Just business, corporate, you know, computer programmer, that kind of stuff. I mean, nothing in the business. Although I will say they're both really very funny, which is, you know, I come from a very funny family. My mom is probably the funniest person I've ever met. My dad doesn't know he's funny, but he is. And yeah, so I come from a really funny family. So, I mean, honestly, around the kitchen table, like, I don't even get a joke in a lot of times because they're always so quick. And so, yeah. But then I'm the only one who has the nerve to stand on stage. So that's where I can shine.
Yeah. Well, listen, that's the difference. It's one thing doing it in front of the ones who love you. They can't kill you, you know, or they shouldn't want to kill you. But, your mother, how does that happen? How does somebody become just funny naturally? And you know, usually people say, oh, my dad was the funniest guy. But how is it that your mom is funny? Were her parents like encouraging her to talk at a young age and to tell stories? I mean, how does that happen? How does a woman that doesn't do comedy for a living, you know, get like that?
I think, you know, that's a great question, and I don't know if there's any one way. I know that, you know, we come from an Irish background, and that's always sort of the gift of the gab. You know, the Irish sort of have the reputation for always having a good story and, you know, drinking a pint and making someone laugh. So I think there must be something to the gene. And then from there, I mean, honestly, I think, you know, she's a smart person, and most of the really good comics I've met are also, they tend to be smart people, and I don't know if that, you know, helps you add two and two together or something, but yeah, I mean, she's also the smartest person I ever met. So,
well, I mean, how about you? I mean, you're comedy smart. I mean, you know, you do observational stuff, but you could appeal to a higher market. I mean, you're not, you know, throwing pies in people's faces and, you know, things like that. But were you encouraged as a kid to tell stories, like, or to talk with people early on, saying, "Yeah, come on, tell me how your day went." I mean, what was your upbringing like, and how do you get to this point? And early on, what kind of signs did you see?
I always loved making people smile. That was one of the things. I mean, making someone smile or making someone laugh, making someone feel good. That was always been part of me. Like, I always in school, I was, you know, nervous, and there was some guys who were, you know, the good looking guys, and there were some guys who were, and I kind of quickly learned that I could make a girl smile, you know, not that it was all about trying to impress women, but you learn, you know, and guys as well, actually, in terms of acceptance and friends, you get, you know, quickly a sense that that was my in, like, I don't even think I was thinking it. I think it's just instinctual when you're a kid. You're like, oh, people like me when I'm funny, so I'm gonna keep doing that. And yeah, and it made me more comfortable. Like, it diffused situations. It was, you know, if I was nervous or uncomfortable somewhere, if I made a joke, it usually helped. And so I think I quickly identified that it was my one thing that I was good at. And from there, you know, you don't give it up, especially, like I said, when the girl across the room smiles or laughs at something you said, you go, oh, I like this feeling. So yeah. Let's do more of that.
Well, Michael Somerville, once again, is our very special guest, and he's a writer and he's an actor, but first and foremost, he's a stand-up, and he's a
whatever they'll pay me to do that day.
he is a great stand-up, and I'm saying great. And I've been trying to get him on for the longest time. He'll tell you, I practically stalked him to get him on, but thrilled to get him.
I finally have a stalker. Thank God.
Frank,
you weren't exactly what I pictured, but I'll take it.
Frank McKay here with Michael Somerville. Let me ask you this. When did you find your confidence? And again, when I say confidence, I don't mean, you know, the ability to walk up to a girl or whatever. But when did you find the confidence in your life where you could actually stand on stage and feel good about what was going to happen, whether you got booed or not? When did that come in your life?
Wow, that's a great question. And I would say, unbelievably, it wasn't so recently. I mean, I've been doing this is my 20th year right now. 20 years ago I started. And hard to believe, but I would say it's really only in the last few years that I genuinely, you know, I can't say stopped caring, because of course you care and you want to be funny and you want the audience to like you, but I would watch guys, you know, like Bill Burr and some of these guys, and Louis C.K., these guys would just get up, and they would just not, you could tell they didn't care. And again, I don't mean that to sound like they don't care, but they're expressing themselves, they're being themselves, and they're saying what they think is funny, and it's up to the audience to come along. And I, for the longest time, was, you know, a clown, trying to please, trying to make them happy, and I still think I am to a degree. But it's only probably in the last 2 or 3 years that I started to go, oh, no, I'm starting to, you know, this is now 17 years in. I think I am funny. Maybe I should stop, you know, crying and begging for people's approval and be a little more confident. And so it took me a long, long time, part of that 8 years of Catholic school and guilt and all that stuff. But yeah. I finally feeling pretty good about myself.
Yeah, you know, you mentioned Bill Burr and Louis C.K. I mean, two of the greats of this generation, and
absolutely,
and certainly Bill Burr. If you look at some early things that Bill Burr did, you knew there was talent there. There was funny there, but there's a certain point where he just became Bill Burr, and it probably wasn't all that long ago. I mean, it was, you know, you said the last couple of years for you. Maybe it's the last 10 years. For Bill Burr, where he became it. But go ahead, you were going to say.
No, I think you're exactly right. I think that's, you know, what they say. It just takes hours and hours of time on stage to really, I mean, really to just become yourself. You get up there, and it's hard to act natural on a stage in front of a bunch of people. It's hard to act like yourself, and it takes a lot of swings at bat to get to that point. And I agree with you. I mean, you see it now, and he can take, you know, you develop that voice and you hone that machine, and you can take any topic now and just put it right through that grinder and, you know, spit out genius.
Yeah, I mean, he like found his groove. And not to go off too much on Bill Burr, but I've seen some, you know, there's been moments where I've been watching Bill Burr and I thought to myself, this is the funniest guy on earth. You know, I mean, this guy is absolutely great, you know.
Yeah, I would have to agree with you. I mean, you know, it amazes me still to this day. People who are not in the business will ask me who I think, you know, is the best or who's my favorite. And I usually say Bill, and they, it's, you know, I would say 60% of the time they haven't heard of him. And
yeah,
I just go, how's that possible?
Yeah. Well, you know, we're all in a cocoon or you know, either that or a fishbowl or whatever, but a cocoon in many ways. I'm the same way with a guy like Bill Burr. I've said you to some people, and you know, I know you haven't gotten the attention. You didn't have Breaking Bad, by the way. That kind of helped launch him too.
Absolutely.
You know, when that happened, and if you think about it, it had nothing to do with comedy.
And he's in a new Apatow movie now. He just shot the new Apatow movie in Staten Island this summer. So next year he'll be in a movie, and I think it'll start to really pop for him.
Yeah, and the thing is that it's interesting to watch these careers develop, and like I've been watching you, you know, over the last several years, and you just seem like you're that one thing away from just exploding, and again, it's a compliment, you know. When I watch you, I realize, hey, this is a guy who really should be doing comedy, you know, and this is what the guy should be doing. And I don't know how many people I could say that about. It's you know, a decent amount, but not everybody who's doing comedy should be doing comedy. And
yeah,
you know, if they want to do it, you know, by all means, do it. But there's certain people that you watch and you say, you know, hey, this, you know, I don't know. I don't want to be like some people got it and some people don't. But you could tell when somebody really cares enough about being good.
Oh, yeah.
You know.
No, I think you're right. Yeah.
Well, you mentioned Louis C.K. and Burr and the fact that both of them, they don't care. They don't care that whether they get booed or not. They're going up there, and like you said, you know, they don't care about that. But they cared somewhere along the line to get really good. And let me ask you this, and I guess I ask this to a lot of people, but out of everybody you've seen and you've been around and you've watched their careers go, do you see a common trait in comedians of the guys that really take off or who have lasting success or a steady, you know, permanent career? Is there a common trait to those guys aside from, say, talent or whatever? Is there something else you see in those guys?
I would say, yeah, I would say write and perform. Those are the two words that, and I feel bad saying that because it doesn't mean anyone who decides to write and perform is going to make it or is going to become a great comedian. But the guys that I've seen and women I've seen who have popped or really found their voice or honed or really making some noise, they worked. And I know it sounds like a trite answer, but it's really, really true. I know really funny people who sit in bars at night and talk about doing comedy. And then I know people who go home and write and get back on stage the next night. Bill Burr is a great example. He was in New York pounding out sets right before his first HBO half-hour special, if you remember that first half-hour that really sort of started to get people's attention. It was a 30-minute HBO special. And in the year leading up to that, 6 months leading up to that, I was doing a lot of spots in New York late night, you know, Broadway on 53rd Street, that, you know, downstairs club at, you know, 1 in the morning, and it was three people in the audience. I mean, any room you could imagine, I was just taking whatever I could get, and Burr would come in. It didn't matter what show, where it was, and he would be doing 5 new minutes of material based on what happened that day. And you knew it was new because it was literally happened that day. And I remember watching him going, that's just, I mean, it's amazing. And he was up there, and he was committing, and he was, yeah. And so a guy, he just did the work. And, I mean, there's no, obviously, substituting. And there probably are. The funniest comedians on the planet are probably, you know, serving a drink somewhere right now to someone because they just never decided to commit to it.
Michael Somerville, everyone, if you're just joining us, if you're turning on your radio a little late, Frank McKay here with Michael Somerville. Just a great stand-up and terrific. He's an actor and a writer as well. Frank McKay here with Michael.
And apparently a philosopher now.
Hey, do you have a book out? And pardon my ignorance. Do you have a book out?
No. The only thing I used to write for, you know, Glamour magazine. I did their relationship column, Jake, A Man's Opinion. So I was a magazine columnist and a dating expert, quote unquote. A lot of women would disagree with that, but yeah, I used to give relationship advice. But no, I never actually wrote a book. I've written, you know, a few, what do you call them? Like, you know, samples. I've written a few screenplays and all that kind of stuff that we're all supposed to be doing. And nothing that you would know in the stores or in the movie screens yet, but we're working on it.
You know, I used to own clubs when I was younger, you know, in my early 20s and 30. And we used to own rock clubs. But every once in a while, we would do an open comedian, you know, the mic for comics. And we
sure.
would get some, you know, some notable guys, at least at the time and whatever, coming into some, you know, some rinky-dink place on Long Island, New York, and they'd come in there and they'd just work out material. And they'd always say, look, stage time is so valuable. If you have these things, let us know in advance so I could book, you know, whatever. And stage time back then was like, was gold and people were looking for it. Is it still like that? I mean, in general, is it like that?
Oh, 100%. It's stage time is everything. Well, like I said, write and perform. The only two things you really have to do. I mean, obviously it's a little more complicated than that, but at the end of the day, when any new comic asks me for advice, I say write and perform. You can write all you want. We have 100% control over that. You can go home and write 5 hours a night if you want to. And perform, that's harder. And that's, you know, obviously someone needs to agree to put you on a stage in front of an audience. But the one thing I did, you know, I remember hearing early on, like, you know, it takes you 10 years to get out of your own way. It takes you, you know, 8 years to find your voice. It takes 12 years to get comfortable. All those, you know, little sayings that you hear. And so I would do shows in my own apartment, in my own basement. I would just do a show for the wall because I realized that half the, you know, I was the problem at the beginning. I, you know, figuring out how to say words, figuring out how to stand up and present them like comedy, figuring out I mean, all that. I said, you know what? If you can't get a show, do a show in your own apartment. And I remember, like, you know, some of my friends would laugh. What are you talking about? Do a show in your own apartment? Yeah. And I was like, I don't know. I just think there's something to be said for saying the words out loud as though you're on the stage, even though no one's there listening or laughing. I think it helped a lot. It started to help me with economy of words, how to say something, how to, you know, just commit. And then you get a show and you've already, you know, it's almost like a play. I mean, how many times do you practice a play before you do it in front of a live audience? And obviously you need the audience that, you know, to find out if it really is funny. But I think there was something to be said for just the reps of what I did. But of course, at the end of the day, there's nothing like a live audience. That's how you find out whether or not something's funny.
I mean, that's terrific, though. I mean, you know, that everything you just said is terrific. Michael Somerville is our very special guest. And just a wonderful stand-up, and again, actor and former writer, column writer for Glamour magazine, which is a big deal. Hey, Glamour's got a good audience, that's for sure.
Well, like I said, it was like as soon as like magazines were going out of style, no one was reading them anymore. That's when I got the job.
Frank McKay here once again with Michael Somerville. And if you're just rejoining us, just a reminder, you're listening to Breaking It Down. But much more importantly, our very special guest is Michael Somerville. And he is a stand-up. He has a lot of respect out there among other comedians. A lot of guys I talk to, you know, privately, you know, say, oh, you know, Somerville's great. You know, there's and they're hearing you the same way I'm hearing you. Or maybe they're seeing you in clubs and things like that. But Sirius has been a godsend for comedians. It has to be. And again, from somebody,
yeah,
you know, like that's outside observing in, I mean, how great has SiriusXM been for your field?
It's been wonderful. You know, I mean, the internet in general and obviously SiriusXM, all the ability to get out there and get heard and seen is wonderful. You know, back in the day, it was, like you said, two or three TV networks, and that was it. And then a couple of radio stations if you went to a local market. But, I mean, in general, you know, to have the ability to get your content out there and you know, reach your audience, you know, kind of cut out the middleman. Oh, you know, you decide what to listen to. Sirius has been great. Super thankful for them for playing my stuff. And, yeah, it's just, you know, it's nice because you can all of a sudden find out that, yeah, there's a group in Kansas or something. You know, you have a bunch of fans in Kansas. I never would have known about it if it wasn't for the internet. And then, you know, they find me on Facebook and they support my stuff and they retweet my jokes and go, oh gosh, this is wonderful. So yeah, very thankful.
Yeah, you know, it's just wonderful talking to somebody about a business that we're not in, because there's like no risk there, but at the same time people can apply it to other things and listeners could apply it. You know, you mentioned sales or business or whatever, but let me ask you, who was the first person you met in the business that took you under your wing or even attempted to start giving you advice?
There was two, you know, a couple of names come to mind. Tom Shalhoub, who now works with, you know, on Fox and does some of the radio stuff on Fox and everything. He was a New York comic who was booking a lot of commercials, and he was a few years ahead of me starting out in New York. And I remember him telling me to just, you know, just work hard and get so funny that they know they're going to make money off of you. That was what he said to me. That just get so good that people are going to know they're going to make money off of you and they'll find you. And so I thought that was great advice, you know, because everyone gets worried. You have all these questions initially of all these things you want to, and like, no, you just control what you can control. And the funnier you get, someone's going to look and go, oh, that guy, I'll take 10% of what he's going to make. So I thought that was pretty good advice. And then Mitch Faitel, who a very different style, I think he's a fabulous comedian. He's a little bit more off color with some of his material and content. But a great writer, and he actually took me on the road when I was, you know, I was funny but not great, and I was having trouble getting bookings, and I wasn't sure, and he made me his opener for about four years, and that was really, really helpful because I got to watch him on the road, and the road can be such chaos for a comedian. You can, you know, any number of things. You can imagine get into late nights and trouble or what, you know, and Mitch would set an alarm and get up and go to the gym and then sit down and write for 30 minutes and then go to lunch and then sit down for write for another 30 minutes and then listen to his show from the night before. It was just like watching a military, you know, guy. And it was so impressive to me, because to me, the road was like, hey, let's go get some beers and see if, you know, see what's open for midnight snacks. And it was great to watch him be so disciplined. And I remember he told me, he said, you know, we have our days free for a reason. It doesn't mean to sleep. It means that you're supposed to be working and doing something. And I always thought that was a great take on it.
Yeah. Listen, yeah, it's terrific. It's nice when you're around somebody who's done a little more than you and can get it. Do you remember the first time somebody outside of your immediate family said, hey, you should be doing this for a living, or you should try to do this?
Man, oh, man, that's a good question. I remember, actually, you know, yeah, the first time I ever tried comedy was as a freshman at the University of Notre Dame. That's where I went to college. Wow. And they had a professional coming to campus. Her name was Bertie Berry. I'll never forget her name. She was out of Chicago, and they wanted students to open. They wanted a student to open for her. And I'd never done stand-up before. They put a little ad in the school paper, and all my buddies were, you should do it. You should try. You should, you know, you're funny. And I kind of said, oh, yeah, maybe I'll put together a couple of jokes and you know, see how it goes. And so I worked hard on jokes about cafeteria food and dorm rooms or whatever. I did. All my friends came to, you know, support me. It was a great show. It was a full house. She was hysterical. But I felt good. I got up, and it was my first show ever. And I remember her after the show saying, keep going. That's the two words she said. She said, you, keep going. And I, you know, I didn't even know what she meant. And I said, you know, what are you, you're funny. She said, keep going. And I'll never forget those two words, especially as a freshman in college. It's the last thing my parents wanted me to hear. You know, we're paying this kid's education, and now all of a sudden, but yeah, I remember that was the first. It was my very first show ever, and I remember, yeah, that encouragement. And while I didn't necessarily aspire to be a comedian then, I wound up being like the MC for Notre Dame football pep rallies and all that. I did a lot of like microphone stuff while I was at school. And then I got, you know, serious, moved to New York, got a job in advertising, you know, the whole let's be a businessman, I'll have a corporate job or something, and quickly just got disconcerted with getting up in the morning. I didn't like shaving every day. And all of a sudden I started checking out the open mics, and next thing I know, I was quitting the business, or as I like to say, retired. I was retiring from my day job and pursuing comedy. And it's gone well, just well enough to keep me in it. Every 6 months I look back and go, you know, should I keep doing this? And every 6 months I go, yeah, just going just well enough the last 6 months to just give me another 6 months.
Yeah. How about the first time you bombed? What was the feeling?
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, I mean, you weren't like, oh, I'm quitting or anything like that, right? How bad was the first time you bombed?
Well, you know, I don't know if I remember the first time. I certainly remember, you know, a few times. It's a horrible feeling. And I think the scariest feeling is not having another gear to go to. I don't remember where I was, but one of the first times it just didn't go well. The audience didn't like me. It was, I think, like a half-hour show at a college, and they didn't like me. And so I sped up, which is an absolute rookie mistake. You get nervous, and you speed up and tell your next joke quickly, hoping that's going to get them.
Yeah.
And instead, you ruin the next joke because you just rushed it. So now that didn't work. And then I remember leaving that, whatever subject I was on, I go, all right, let me stop talking about that subject because they're not buying it. But then I realized that I only had about 20 minutes of material. So they were eventually going to hear those jokes. I was going to come back to them later because I didn't have enough material to fill this, you know, fill the time. And I think that's the worst feeling for me, at least, about bombing, is feeling like you're not equipped to handle this situation. You know, you're just, I don't have more jokes. I'm not good enough at crowd work to get out of this. I'm not. You know, and that was a terrible feeling. That's a terrible feeling.
So, I mean, as you go on, and again, Michael Somerville is our very special guest, and check out his material. I'm sure anywhere you could download stuff from him. I don't know if you could buy. Can you buy stuff, Michael, on Spotify?
Please. Spotify, Apple Music. I got 4 albums out at Spotify, Apple Music. You know, all that stuff. They're, you know, streamable, follow. Yeah, please have people follow, because it really, really does help. We get like 0.5 cent every time someone plays a joke. So, yeah. Like, if 100 people listen to me, they can buy a beer.
Michael Somerville, everyone. Frank McKay here with wonderful stand-up. You know, you brought up an interesting point. I never would have thought of that as like a layperson, you know, somebody on the outside of the comedy world. But when you're when you're starting out and you got to do 20 minutes, you don't have like your last 20 minutes to do. This is your first 20 minutes, basically, right? And you can't really draw back. But once you've been doing it for years, you know, once you got four albums worth of material, you can kind of feel out an audience, even if they're, even if it's a crappy audience. And by the way, sometimes there's just bad audiences. You know, you get a you get a big party of people, and they just have no interest in getting into it, or they're drunk and they're too drunk for comedy, or whatever.
Yep.
But you have four albums worth of material to go to. And I mean, have you ever been in a situation, or have you been in a situation in the last few years where you say, you know what, I'm going way back. I have a feeling this audience would respond to blank, and just pulled something out from way long time ago and just threw it in there.
Absolutely. No, no question. You know, you have, even if you have, you're doing 20 years, I got four albums, you still have your best of. And if I'm doing, like, I was just in Vegas 2 weeks ago doing a corporate event for Longhorn Steakhouse. And that was, you know, 100% the best of all my material. There are still jokes that I wrote, you know, 15 years ago that are great, funny jokes. They're evergreen, you know, they're timeless. And they still work. And so if I'm getting paid, you know, well, to do a corporate event, and I think they need the A game, I definitely have a master set that's, you know, that's it. That said, yes, of course, you always want to be working new material, working in, because you change as a person. You know, it's like a musician. You know, an album that you two made 20 years ago, or an album that, you know, whoever made it when they first started, is not going to sound like the music they make, you know, now. And I think the same is true of comedy. You start to, you know, you change your voice, your point of view, your life perspective all changes. I definitely have original jokes that I love and will still do, especially, you know, at a corporate or on a cruise ship or something, where you feel like, oh, these people need the A game.
You've mentioned writing. How do you write, and what do you use to write with? Are you using your, like, iPhone, and you're talking into it? You're not actually sitting at a computer or with pen and paper. I mean, what do you do? What's your methodology?
Literally all of the above, all four things you just said. You know, type it on a phone, say it out loud, write it into your voice text, sit down and type it, write it on a napkin at a bar, you name it. There's no one way. And some of my best ideas just come to me, and then eventually I try to sit down and hash them out and hone them. But yeah, there's really, I don't have any system. Like, you know, I said, Mitch Fatel would sit at 9:30 and set his alarm for 9:33 and say, okay, now I'm done writing for that half hour. I don't have anything like that. I probably should. I'd probably, you know, be more productive if I was that disciplined. But yeah, my only rule is I try to write something every single day. Even if it's just one joke that I'm going to put on Twitter, I try to force myself to write every day, even if it's for 5 minutes, just because I believe that I have this theory that we all have this, we have something inside of us each day. And I try to find that little gem each day, because if I don't, it's gone forever. It means I didn't dust off, I didn't find it, and I can never get it back, so I missed the opportunity. So yeah, I try to, at a minimum, do a joke every day, and to hold myself, you know, accountable, I'll post it on Twitter or Facebook, though, and sometimes I'll have people write to me, go, hey, where's the joke today? And, you know, I didn't get a joke in my inbox, or I didn't get a joke in my Twitter feed today, where's your joke?
That's a compliment when they ask you that. That's a compliment. That means they're paying attention and they just haven't seen it. So that's great.
Well, it's certainly better when they say, okay, that was try again tomorrow. That joke. No, you can delete that joke. but yeah, and the other thing I'll do is talk about discipline. And, you know, again, like you said, it applies to many different fields, not just comedy, not just entertainment, but, you know, work hard. It's obviously something you hear in everything. And then also, you know, find new ways to create, or to be you know, don't follow the leader, do your own way. So like I said, I would do shows in my room, in my apartment, to nobody. That, you know, other comics would laugh at me for doing that, but you're going, I don't know, I'm pretty sure I got something out of it. What you do, you know, what, you just watch TV? And then the other thing I do, and I still do to this day, in fact I'll start tomorrow, I hit the road tomorrow for 2 months, and I have a bunch of material that I want to work out, and but I have some pretty important shows. So it's going to be hard to work those jokes in. And you can't, you know, if you're getting paid well and you're, you know, people are expecting, you can't really do a ton of new jokes. At least I feel, you know, I owe a certain level of quality. So what I do is I make videos out of about 1 or 2 minute stand-up videos of this brand new material. I'll put a 2 minute show together. And then I'll send it to my brother, and he's like a great judge. He's good sense for my voice. He's got a great humor. And I'll, you know, it's almost like doing an open mic on the internet, but I don't, you know, it's not public. I don't post it anywhere. I just send it to my brother, and he'll write back the jokes you liked, the jokes you didn't, the ones he thought were good, you know, that kind of, and it's a way of, you know, almost like a halfway house of just getting some of these new jokes out there. And if there's a joke that he likes and I like, I might have a little more nerve then to try it maybe that night on stage. So, okay, someone heard it, someone thought it was good. Let's give it a try.
Do you have a go-to place in different parts of the country to go and to do 5 minutes or to work something out? I'm sure you have in your hometown, but are there places around the country that you go to that you don't necessarily perform at, but you could kind of, you know, slip in there and work out an impromptu?
Only in New York, really. The Comedy Cellar is my home club, and they have a new joke night every Monday and Thursday night, and you get 5 minutes. And the audience knows that you are there doing brand new material. You can get up with notes in your hand. You can do. And so, yeah, that's whenever I'm in town, I try to go to the Comedy Cellar. Obviously, a great club down in McDougal. And there's three rooms now. And, yeah, I'll work out by just was there on Monday night. And I had up. I was on stage with, you know, literally with pages, which was, by the way, really funny. I was up there. I'm in my 40s. I was on stage with printed out pages of jokes. All the younger comics are up there with their phones. You know, no one prints anything now. Yeah. So they had all their jokes on their phone, but I had these big old, you know, large font printed jokes. But yeah, that's where I go. And it's a great night, a great room, because you have really good comics, but everyone knows, like, give them the benefit of the doubt. This is brand new.
If I'm remembering correctly, the Boston Comedy Cellar, it was owned by a manager, right? He managed comedians, and he was, like, in the business?
The Boston was a separate club. The Comedy Cellar... McDougal, and then the Boston was around the corner. And the Comedy Cellar is owned by not a manager, Noam Dorman, but at the Boston that I think you mentioned, that was owned by a manager. Yeah. Yeah, that was. That's no longer there, but that was owned by a manager. Yeah. Yeah.
Are there places that you play that maybe they don't, you know, maybe the pay is not as great, but you know, there's going to be a certain clientele there, maybe, you know, maybe some key comedic talent there watching others, and it kind of spreads it, or certainly that you can look at as a showcase, maybe some TV people and folks that book. Are there places like that?
Yeah, it's called Los Angeles. and yeah. But yeah, that is, you know, the blessing and the curse of L.A. Like almost every audience in L.A., especially in the main clubs right there, the Improv and the Laugh Factory, and then not so much Hermosa. I do Hermosa Beach Comedy Magic, but that's a little out of the loop down there. But the Comedy Store on Sunset, they all almost inevitably have network people, TV people, agents. There's almost always an industry, they call it, in the crowd. And it's a nightmare because those people don't laugh, you know. You do a show in Chicago and you got nothing but fun people who want to have a good time and laugh, but you get a room full of industry or half industry, or even just, you know, sometimes LA, you just sort of get the people who are trying to look cool or somehow be, it's just not a genuine comedy audience. And I'm not being unkind. I think everyone would say, tell you the same thing, including them. So yeah, you go out to do these showcases and you hear all these agents are going to be in the audience, and then they're just staring at you, and then they're texting, you know, on their phones, and you go, oh, this is no fun at all. Give me the middle of the country any day.
Is there anything that you learned later on in your career that you really wish you could tell your younger self and you think it would have changed things for the better?
Yeah, that's tough. I mean, I feel like I did a really good job making the best decisions for myself based on all the information that I had at the time. So there's no question I look back and go, oh, what if I had done that more? What if I had, you know, moved to LA is always a big thing for comics, or, you know, hooked up or networked more with, you know, the other comics that were on the rise. So once they, you know, made it, then all of a sudden they would hire me as a writer for their show. Or, I mean, you can see how different things panned out for different people in this business, and you go, oh, that was, you know, but you know, I don't know if I have any real, you know, regrets. I did my best with what I had at the time, you know. I remember at one, when I was early on, I was talking to my dad on the cell phone once, and he said, what are you doing? And he said, I'm hanging out in this comedy club. I said, what do you mean you're hanging out? He's like, I don't know, I just I've been told you're supposed to hang out. Like, I'm standing and leaning against the wall. And I'm leaning against the wall, and no one's talking to me, and I'm hanging out. And obviously now I look back and get it. Like, oh, there's a, you know, there is a sense of networking. There is an importance of being seen and being around. But he said, well, it doesn't sound that productive. He said, why don't you go home and write a joke? And I was like, that's great advice. Why would I hang out when I could, you know, be home writing a joke? And so I think about that all the time because I, as a result, I got pretty good at writing jokes. But at the same time, you know, you look back and go, oh, gosh, you know, maybe if I hung out more, would I be friends now with, I don't know, you know, someone who's got their own TV show or someone who's, you know, I don't know, you know, yeah. Hiring a writing staff for their thing. So, yeah, I it's easy to question, but all I know is I did my best.
Listen, all I know is you do what you do very, very well. And Michael Somerville has been our very special guest, Frank McKay, here with Michael. And he is a great stand-up, and he's put together a really wonderful career. He's an actor and a writer as well. Glamour magazine. How about that? Glamour magazine.
Yeah.
what do you call it? Contributor. And he was the dating expert. So if anybody has any questions on dating or relationships, Michael's the expert. He's the recognized expert in the world, but on all of that. But anyway, listen. What can you leave us with? Do you have a social media page or a website where people can kind of follow along?
Absolutely. Well, I'm redoing the website. It is michaelsomerville.com. But that's I'm redoing it and trying to get hit with the kids. But I have all this stuff, I'm on Facebook and, Twitter is Somerville Puns, Instagram is Michael Somerville. And like I said, most importantly, I mean, these albums are out there on SiriusXM and Apple Music and all. And yeah, if you encourage, please do, people to follow not only me or, listen to my stuff, but all anyone you like that you hear out there and you're enjoying them, take that extra second to click and put them in your queue or whatever, because it really helps us. Those numbers, it's not going to make us rich, but it helps everything. It's just we get in the mix and all of a sudden more people hear us, and it's the way you can help a comedian if you really want to.
Well, listen, once again, congratulations. You put together a really wonderful career, and more importantly, you've honed a skill that very few people have, and you do it very, very well. Michael Somerville.
Would you mind calling my parents and telling them all that?
Tell them to call me. I'm gonna vouch for you. Yeah, they'll be like, "Who the hell is he? What are you wasting time with him? Go write jokes."
I'm gonna make you my PR person.
Well, listen, you're terrific. Thanks again.
I appreciate it. Thanks for having me, Frank.
Michael Somerville, everyone, has been our very special guest. Frank McKay here with a very funny guy, but just check out his stand-up. It's terrific. And, yeah, click like and download the stuff on Spotify. And what a great stand-up Michael is. And you can hear him on XM. And you've heard him throughout the years on David Letterman. And something I just found out, he's the relationship expert, according to Glamour magazine, but he was writing as a contributor there, and that's funny all its own. That's interesting, But I'll tell you what, it's prestigious. You add Letterman and Glamour magazine together, you got a pretty damn good resume right there. But Michael Somerville has been our very special guest. Frank McKay signing off. We'll see you all next time on Breaking It Down.